Cynthia Bastian.
And I'm Aubrey Calvin, and this is Southern Queries,
exploring all things LGBTQ in the South.
Hey y'all, I've been excited about this episode for a long time. In our community, we do not talk enough about all the different letters in our alphabet. I think we need to do a better job at it. As you will hear in this episode, we highlight how the I in LGBTQIA tends to be a complicated one, especially for a person who identifies or is intersex. I want folk who are allies or maybe new to the LGBTQIA world that intersex people are individuals born with any of several sex characteristics, including chromosome patterns, gonads, or genitalia, that according to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner of Human Rights, do not fit typical binary notions of male or female bodies. And I say that in quotation marks. In this episode, we talk a lot about what it means for both a queer and intersex guest and how they have navigated this world as an intersex person. What does it look like falling in love as an intersex person? I want to note that at the time of this recording, the intense attacks on our LGBTQIA community was not as intense as it is today. This was recorded almost a year ago. Today, I think folk both in the queer community and our allies have really forgotten about the I in our alphabet, especially when it comes to the legislation that has recently come into play so aggressively into the U.S. These anti-trans bills harm intersex kids and harm intersex adults. I have noticed that the folk who are pro-legislation or against trans folk seem to change their tune when I explain how the bills could harm intersex folk. It's almost like they have an easier time thinking about the binary than they do about non-binary. I also find myself explaining, more often than not, what intersex is, as there was a formerly other name that we used for folk like this. Please note that we do touch on some of these topics during the interview, so you have some warning. I hope you listen with an open mind and open heart, and as always, enjoy. Okay, so I did have another question. How did you two meet?
Bumble.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. I snatched her right off the internet.
That's awesome. Aubrey, I need you to also do some talking so I can make sure your levels are good.
I was about to ask you what Bumble was.
Oh, it's a dating app.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. It's like Tinder, but less one night standy.
Oh. Yeah. See, my wife and I are old school. We met at eHarmony. Back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
3 years ago.
Prior to that, to meeting him, like I was with somebody for 9 years and we were married, and like my dating prior to that was like meeting at the bar, or I did Yahoo Personals. Like that's forever ago, Yahoo Personals.
Yes.
And then I, you know, was single again and started dating. I'm like, well, I guess I'll try an app. I don't know. They seem like everybody's having fun on them. So yeah.
And I had been on the apps for a while. I also was in a very long-term relationship prior to meeting her, but like had enough like time in between where I could kind of experiment with the apps and was like literally like minutes away from deleting all of it because I was like, this just, the dynamic here doesn't work for who I am. And it's very difficult to explain to someone like what they're getting through Bumble and like, you know, just the general process of self-identifying there is so narrow. Mm-hmm. And it was, I just never swiped right on anybody ever. And so like, you know, maybe at like one out of, you know, 300, I'd be like, oh yeah, okay. You look like we would get along, like you seem intelligent. And then I saw her and I was like, I'll give it one more shot. So I swiped and then I got a match like, I don't know, like the next day. And I was like, oh, is it Emily? And it was. And then here we are 2.5 years later.
Engaged, right?
Yes.
Engaged.
Yes.
Engaged.
All right. My levels look good. Did you already start recording over there? We're good. Mm-hmm. I think we're good. Cool. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I was very curious about this, but that was also like really awesome audio.
Hold up. Rewind. We jumped in a little bit too fast. Let's rewind that.
So really, we want to start out with introducing yourselves. And if you're comfortable, what are your pronouns? And hi, how do you identify?
Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
You go ahead.
Okay. I'm Emily. My pronouns are she, her. I identify as a queer person. I am, not to offend anyone, but I'm open to dating. I'm attracted to any gender pretty much except for like cis men. I've mostly dated women, married to a woman, but yeah, I just identify as queer.
Awesome.
All right. I'm Lane. My pronouns are he, him. I am intersex, although I think intersex is not necessarily as much of an identity as it is who I am. Not to say that you can't identify as intersex if you are intersex, but I also guess I identify as a member of the queer community, but am only attracted to women, have only ever dated women. And so I guess in a way I'm a straight queer. I don't know.
If that's straight it. Man, so boring. My least favorite quality about
it is boring, and I don't even think that what I said is a category that exists. But
we're gonna make it.
It does now.
It now exists. I spoke it into existence. So
let's add to the alphabet and piss off straight people even more than we already have.
So I do have a follow-up question. I know I just asked you how you guys met. Mm-hmm. I'll insert the audio right there. Mm-hmm. What side of Bumble were you on?
So this is where the messiness of the apps for me really became really too much, and why I was ready to get off of it, because even though I really, prior to Emily, had only really dated straight women, but I also thought, if I'm in this digital dating space, it didn't necessarily feel safe to me to present as a cis man on an app, because of where we are geographically. So the idea of running into a situation where I could, you know, match with someone who was not necessarily understanding of what it means to be an intersex person.
Yeah.
And then, you know, send daddy after me with a shotgun. while that sounds extreme, was a legitimate fear for me.
For sure.
So I got into the women seeking women, which I think is also not an accurate representation whatsoever, but it felt safer and really like, it did cause me to like expand what I thought was appropriate for me, I guess. And it's a kind of a weird way to put it, but having only ever dated straight women, I didn't necessarily know if I would get along with a woman who was not interested in dating a man. Like, I didn't know how that would impact my identity as an intersex man. Like, would that put too many, you know, feminine impositions on me? Am I secure enough in who I am and in my masculinity to be able to say, yeah, I'll, you know, date a woman who's not trying to date a cis man, I guess. It was an interesting dynamic for me.
It was a lot of conversation in the beginning of our relationship.
Yes.
So,
sure, yeah, I can imagine.
Which is, again, why, like, meeting people in person has always been so much easier for me, because when people meet me, it's like, oh, I get it. Like, before I even really necessarily have to explain what it is, like, people can feel that there's a massive difference between me and... You know, I'll be very like open about this. I was socialized as a girl. I was not identifiable as intersex at birth. And so, you know, and up until puberty, you know, this was just kind of the way my gender role was assigned. And then as you know, life continued to happen, it became clear that that was not the correct one. So, you know, there's always been a real, you know, there, it has been a transition. It's been a social transition, you know, in later in life to really, be comfortable, I think, with, with presenting this way and not feeling the need to explain myself at every turn.
Okay. I felt like I had to interject a little bit, I wanted to offer a little bit more context and historical information about the term intersexuality and also explain a little bit about what Lane is talking about with even more context. Obviously, it's different from each person, and each intersex folk might have very different variations of how their life develops and unravels or becomes more living their most truth. So the term intersexuality was coined by Richard Goldsmith in 1917's paper Intersexuality and the Endocrine Aspect of Sex. This first suggestion to replace the term hermaphrodite with intersex came from the British specialist Kawa Diaz, not sure if I'm pronouncing their name correctly, back in the 1940s. This suggestion was taken up by specialists in the UK during the 1960s. 1960s, y'all, it wasn't that long ago. Since the rise of modern medical science in Western societies, some intersex people with ambiguous external genitalia have had their genitalia either surgically modified to resemble either female or male genitals. Surgeons pinpointed intersex babies as, quote, a social emergency once they were born. The parents of intersex babies are not content about the situation, and psychologists and sexologists and researchers frequently still believe that it is better for a baby's genitalia to be changed when they are younger than when they're a mature adult. These scientists have believed that early intervention helped avoid gender identity confusion. This was called the optimal gender policy and was initially developed in the 1950s by John Money. Money and others believed that children would in general develop a gender identity that matched the sex of rearing. This sense has been challenged and actually disproven based on part of Money's inaccurate reporting of success for infant sex reassignment by David Raymer. The goal of the assignment was to choose the sex that would lead to the least inconsistency between external autonomy and assigned psyche, quote, gender identity. Since advances in surgery have made it possible for intersex conditions to be, quote, concealed, many people are not aware of how frequently intersex conditions arise in human beings or that they occur at all. And I do want to point out that surgery isn't always the answer. There's a lot of intersex folk that don't ever choose surgery. It's also been a big hot topic debate. And when Lane is talking about being conditioned female, it doesn't lead or tell us anything about what's in their pants. And frankly, none of us should care. The dialogue between that were once agnostic groups of activists and clinicians has led to only slight changes in medical policies and how intersex patients and their families are treated in some locations, and even more importantly, well-informed. Numerous civil rights society organizations and human rights institutions now call for an end for unnecessary, quote, normalizing interventions. Honestly, I feel like we could have an entire episode talking about the first public demonstration of what intersex people took place, of actually demonstrating how much they were against it back in October 26, 1996 in Boston. Outside the venue in Boston was the American Academy of Pediatrics, and they were holding their annual conference. The group demonstrated against, quote, normalizing treatments and carried signs saying hermaphrodites with attitude. This event is now commemorated by the Intersex Awareness Day. That is October 26th. Y'all, there is so much more information that I feel like I could spend another hour just talking about. historically what has happened with intersex folk and how much we've evolved, not only in our science, but also understanding what it means to be an intersex person. So the fact that Lane chose to share so openly about how they were raised and how it brought him where he is today is truly something very special. Okay, back to the episode. Totally. Yeah. God, thank you. I mean, meeting online, Aubrey, I know you said you have never been on Bumble because you've been married for a long time.
My wife and I have been married forever, pre-app days. Mid-2000s.
And the reason why.
Yeah. No, we've been doing it online. Yeah. Just with the internet, with like razors and I didn't know, like right when iPhones first came out, so yeah. apps were and everything, so you yeah, yeah. to go through like a browser, so
yeah,
we
yeah.
have to eHarmony, just mm-hmm. well, not swiping.
Right, yes.
right. Well, and if anyone in our audience has ever or not ever used Bumble or any other dating app, you can filter to a certain extent your preferences. You can prefer women versus men. From the last time I was on an app, which was a long time ago, I don't remember there being another category. Gory.
I also think
it depends on which yeah. platform.
I was listed as other.
Okay.
And, which was,
it was problematic within itself.
Still, yes, because it's like, yeah. Because then, you know, mm-hmm. if you.
And I didn't know that. Like, I didn't yeah. see that on when I saw your profile. I might not have been looking. I think I just saw you and said yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
That makes me sound really shallow. I didn't even know. I just, yes. yeah.
I had a carefully curated profile. Shout out to my niece who took it, and also to a good friend of mine who gave me extensive coaching prior to vacation on how to get a good photo. Kenzie Sparks,
seems
thank
like
you.
So much work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was like hard pass.
I had two photos of me, and one was with a friend from. I'm like, oh, I'll look good. Standing next to him, I'll come out looking better. So
that's kind of smart.
It wasn't like planned. I just didn't have pictures of me. So
yeah.
I didn't know it was that much work to get the right photo.
Yeah. Well, now that everyone has like a pretty decent camera, it's the expectation is that your profile should, I feel at least like your profile should represent that, you know, if you want to be competitive.
All right. Yeah. Before I get too like into it down the rabbit hole of your dating life and your relationship, I do have a couple of questions that are a little bit more directed to you, Lane. Yeah. Although Emily, I'm sure you can equally answer. Something that really stood out to me, even prior to even meeting you, is everyone knows what LGBT and even the Q stands for. Mm-hmm. But I have found in my own community and people I know, not everyone knows what the I stands for. I also find that it's not widely talked about in the media. I don't think we hear enough about it. So even the A, for that matter. And then anything else after the LGBTQ is almost like forgotten. So
I would get left out of all of it, really.
Yeah. So I guess I have two questions for you. What would you want our own LGBTQIA community to know? And what would you like all people to know about the intersex community?
That's a great question. And really, I mean, what you're speaking to in the question leading up to this, like, there really is a lot of intersex erasure. And I don't necessarily think it's intentional, but we do get kind of lost in the conversation, especially there's a much needed focus on trans rights and elevating the trans community. But intersex and trans, despite not being the same thing, have very inextricable rights. Like you just cannot separate them. What is good for the trans community is good for the intersex community and vice versa. And there is a lot that we really should be trying to do together to fight some of the anti-trans legislation, gubernatorial orders that are, you know, willy-nilly being dispersed by our governor, who I won't even dignify with a name. There's a lot of stuff that impacts both of our groups, and I sometimes think that the intersex community gets a little bit more left out of the conversation because we are, I mean, these are biological manifestations.
Yeah.
Where, and it doesn't, I think for a long time, I felt that, you know, there's this inherent difference between what makes somebody trans and what makes somebody intersex. I don't know. It's what I think I want people to know, though, is that just because we have, you know, this spectrum of differences that classify us as intersex doesn't mean that we're not fighting all the same fights, that we don't need the same community.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is one of the biggest places that it just kind of stings a little bit, is when we're talking about making progress and that, you know, the I and the A at the end are always the ones that get cut off and just there's a little plus sign there, and that's fine. But if you don't know that they were there, that's one way that you just completely take us out of, you know, just the consciousness of the LGBTQ community. Like, if we're never there, if it's always a plus sign, then eventually people forget the I and the A even exist.
Right. And there's more letters after the I.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and the need for community is really incredible. And up until recently, I've really felt alone. Mm-hmm. Like, I would never meet another intersex person. And very fortunately, thanks to Emily, who signed us up to go to this online forum. There was a panel, really, where there were a lot of intersex people talking about issues and rights and, you know, kind of just in general what intersex is. And I saw all of these really wonderful humans getting together and, you know, talking about the causes that they're fighting for and the way they advocate for the community. And I thought, all of a sudden, like, I don't have to be alone in this.
Yeah, so thank you. That was such good information. I was trying to explain to Aubrey how I even came about the both of you. And really, it's, again, here,
well,
Emily.
You know, you meet people so randomly, yes. So easily. And I just like, who are you talking to?
Yeah, no, I'm like, sure, a weird networker. Like, but I stumbled upon Emily's profile on Instagram through Local Queer Collective, if my memory serves me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh my God, I totally resonate with what you're saying about feeling alone. Now, it's no secret, because I talk about this a lot on the podcast, Fort Worth has not proven to be a very warm LGBTQ community for me. Part of the reason why we even have this podcast and the reason how I even met Aubrey was because I was desperately trying to find community. Then later stumbled upon Local Queer Collective, met Molly, who was running it, and was like, oh, yay, oh, you're all in Dallas.
Yep.
And not that Dallas is off limits, but it does create some...
It's inconvenient for us here. It's not as close as everybody thinks it
is. No, it really
like
is
outside
not.
Of DFW, no, people don't know how far... Yeah. Dallas and Fort Worth.
Right, and most people are like, so India, how's it going in Dallas? And I was like, I don't know, I don't live there. But they just kind of group me under the DFW.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But even the representation of Pride here in Fort Worth versus Dallas is like really starkly different. So anytime I see anyone on Local Queer Collective who's based in Fort Worth, mm-hmm. I am shamelessly like, hey, you look like fun, let's be friends.
Same.
Which might kind of come off creepy, but I try and make it as like friendly as possible. But I was particularly intrigued by the both of you because through Emily's stories, I learned that you were intersex. And I was like, I don't know enough intersex information. I don't know enough intersex people, and that's a shame. And I am embarrassed that I didn't know enough about it. And that's why I think it's so important to hear your voice, particularly on our podcast, because it's shameful that other people in the LGBTQ community don't
think about it or bring up their unheard voices. And then the different conversation about Fort Worth and their lack of LGBTQ community stuff, but a different day. I guess I have a follow-up question to that. Emily, what did you know about intersex people before you met Lane?
I mean, I knew intersex people existed. I knew that it was biological. I knew that there was, you know, that there wasn't one like specific way that that manifests in people. It wasn't like really a big deal for me, and I don't mean that to minimize it. But I have always felt attracted to more androgynous people and people who have like masculine and feminine all in one. And
girl,
so,
same.
Yeah. So it was like, when he told me he was intersex, I was like, oh, okay. Like it wasn't, there was no pause. There was, you know, it was just like, okay, great. Like, let's keep going, you know?
Yay.
Awesome. Of course I had to, you know, we had to negotiate between the two of us, like how we would identify as a couple, me being someone who very much identifies as queer, but yeah, I knew what intersex was, and I knew when he told me what that meant. And he actually, we were texting, and I don't remember how it came up, but
that's what I was gonna ask, is how do you bring that up in a conversation?
We had been talking a lot. Yeah. And yeah. And it, we are both, it probably as evidenced by the conversation today, I think we're both people that like to talk about real things, like mm-hmm. surface stuff is not really our strength. And so even when we were just texting, it was always meaningful and significant. And it came up one day and he said, you know, I don't normally tell people this right away because they don't understand it or they don't know what it is, but that brain, talking about my brain, which was a huge compliment for me, like that's my number one. If you tell me I'm smart, then that, you know, you can kind of have anything you want. So yeah, he told me and that was kind of it. It's been a conversation that's been ongoing because I think he's done a lot of work since we've been together on his identity and ensuring that the people around him understand it and respect it. Sure. So it's not like we had a conversation that day and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of like social transition since we've been together. So mm-hmm. it's something that's discussed a lot, but I knew what it was.
Did you always identify as queer?
What do you mean always? Like,
so I'm asking because I have had friends who are either identified as straight and uh-huh. then identified as lesbian mm-hmm. and then their partner transitioned. Oh, it's not uh-huh. the same thing.
Right, yes, yes.
And then they were like, well, I can't be a lesbian anymore yes. because that's no longer applicable because my partner now identifies as a cis man yeah. or whatever the situation is. So I'm just curious, how has your identity changed since you've been with
me? I think it's changed outwardly. It hasn't changed inwardly. Like I said, I've always known that this is what I'm attracted to and there's a spectrum. But I had never had the like occasion to date sure. gender diverse people prior to him. You know, I just hadn't met many trans guys or intersex people or trans women or so it just kind of didn't happen. And so I called myself gay, I called myself a lesbian because I was in practice, you know, because that's the way I was living my life. And I knew that that label probably didn't really fully explain who I am, but I also knew I needed an answer when people asked me what I was, you know, like you got sure. brown eyes, you're gay, right? Like you gotta have the category. And that was my category. So sometimes I still call myself gay and he doesn't mind too much. But you know, I'm just a queer.
But isn't that part of the problem though, is that our hang up on having to have a label or a category mm-hmm. just to facilitate part of that conversation is you're almost forced to pick
mm-hmm. a box.
Something
mm-hmm.
to call yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be part of the problem.
Right.
So my wife is still considers herself straight.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while she was playing around with the idea of being hetero flexible.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When I first started transitioning because you know, when we met, I was still presenting as a cis straight male.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's been on this transition with me. But that's one of the questions we always have is like, what does she call herself? And mm-hmm. she had to go through her own kind of process. So when there are so many labels, you kind of feel the pressure of what do I pick? Can I have multiple? What fits mm-hmm. for me? And I wonder if it hinders the conversation or pushes the conversation.
I totally agree. And I I feel like it's both a little bit. Like, I do feel that labels have been an important part of, like, the queer rights movement and the progress that we've made, because we needed to say this is what we are and we are different. And
it helps
we have
us to be seen.
Right. Yes. And we have specific needs and specific issues and all that stuff. But then I agree, like, it's humanity is so much more complicated than just, like, a label. And I think if most of us are really honest with ourselves, I think our... if we're labeling ourselves something, that probably doesn't really fully describe. I mean, most of us are incidentally anything, you know, like who knows what could happen in a long life.
Well, in some labels, the people don't want to be labeled that way, even though they are part of the community. Like I have a really dear friend and they are trans, but they don't want to be known as the trans guy. Mm-hmm. They just want to be known as
a guy.
The guy. Mm-hmm. So how do they find community and be recognized, but then also not boxed into a world that they are part of, but not really. And then you're like in between two. All right, my next, Aubrey.
I wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, you ask questions.
You had mentioned how you didn't know you were intersex until going into puberty.
Yep.
And this is just me being trans. I find that coming out, I had two transitions. There's the internal one, and then there's how the world around sees you and getting that affirmed. Yeah. Like getting the world to see you, how you finally see yourself. What was that like for you on the internal part of it? Oh. How did you process the news? Did you say you didn't know, your parents didn't know?
Right.
This was news to you?
And as in like his 20s.
Well, yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and say that I've been through puberty about 4 times. which is, and you know, including another.
There's one right now, happening right now.
Happening right now. So, I first became aware of the condition, the intersex condition that I have not that I had it, but the idea of it in high school. And I thought, wow, some of these things really make sense to me. Oh. And it was one of those things that for a while I just kind of thought, this feels like who I am, and it feels like it would explain quite a bit about me. And I'm about to sneeze.
It's going to take a minute.
That is going to be real bad on your audio.
We are leaving that in. You're leaving that in.
this is a very dramatic sneeze for this one.
That was a lot of built up.
I was excited.
What's gonna happen?
Goes on and on and on. And then when it happens, it's terrifying. Okay, so I was aware of some of these other genetic conditions, specifically Klinefelter syndrome. And
from like class?
Yeah,
biology.
From ninth grade biology.
It's a good private school education, right there.
Nothing from biology.
I
was homeschooled, so I'm like, what?
From biology, except the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. I've always been very fascinated by genetics, though. So the way I actually found out and got confirmation of what I had always thought, based on, physical developments through my adolescence and really into early adulthood, and just the general feeling that there was something inherently different about me compared to a cis woman. In 2006, I went to go see a dermatologist who took one look at me and was like, you've got a skin condition I only see in men. I don't know what's going on with you. We're going to try some things, but ultimately I want you to go see this geneticist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so...
That's a good dermatologist.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very strange
female
way,
doctor, right?
Yes,
paying attention to all the things.
Doctor.
Yep.
Not the path that I would have expected to go down to figure these things out, but I had the appointment with the geneticist.
How old were you?
26.
Okay.
I was about to turn 26.
Okay. Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just trying to like picture the time in your life.
No, 26 going on 27. Anyway, so is that right? No, 24 going on 25.
20s.
I was in my mid-20s. Okay. I don't know. I can't do math on the spot sometimes.
That's cool. Neither can I.
So Yes, I was actually 24 when I saw the geneticist. 25 when I, right before I was turned 25 was when I found out. So they did a full physical exam of me to see, like, you know, is there anything that we need to be aware of? And in the exam, there were a lot of notes made about my secondary sex characteristics. And she said, I want to do a karyotype. So got some blood drawn. And a couple of weeks later, I get a call, which is always fun when you get a call from the doctor and they're like, we need you to come in. We can't tell you what it is over the phone. Oh, I'm like, great. What disease am I about to die of? So turns out they wanted me to come in so they could discuss my mosaicism. And what that means is that instead of just having a standard XX chromosome pairing, I also have an XXY, which is Klinefelter male. And then I have 3%, or it's more like 2.5%, XXX. So I have two different trisomies in addition to having a normally paired XX chromosome. And I always thought it was so strange after she gave me this news. She was like, just, you know, don't make anybody feel like you have to have a surgery. Which I understand so much differently now, knowing what is inflicted on intersex children without their consent. It really, it took on an entirely different meaning for me years later to know what this doctor was saying. And at the same time, I thought, well, you know, I'm an adult. I can make those decisions if I... if there is something that, you know, now I feel like will really help me align with my identity as a masculine person, and really now getting this confirmation that genetically I do have, you know, the chromosomal composition of a man. I just don't have the full everything else to go along with it. Like, if I need to do something down the line that helps me affirm that gender, then we'll cross that bridge when we get there. And, you know, 13 years later, we've arrived at the bridge. But at the time, it didn't resonate with me the way it does now, knowing how many intersex youths are impacted by this, by forced surgeries, so that really their parents can feel better about being able to call them something that fits within the gender binary that everybody says we have to fit into. And the long-term health ramifications for those intersex kids that underwent these forced surgeries are devastating.
Aside from whatever identity issues they might have as a
result,
I mean, there are also medical issues.
Right, you're choosing for your kid. So you run the risk that you're going to choose wrong, first of all, because who knows how we're going to develop. And then aside from that, you know, if you're doing forced sterilizations and, you know, genital correction surgeries, which, can we get over the obsession with that, please? Like,
and when you say kids, you're talking about babies.
Yes,
babies.
Like
babies
newborns.
That have no idea what's going on.
Yes,
and
it does
sometimes
happen.
Their parents don't even tell them.
Right.
Yes.
And I'm very fortunate in the fact that I didn't know until later, because I was spared that. And although the population of intersex people does skew closer to 2% of the total population, the population of the intersex people who are identifiable at birth is much smaller. So you're looking more at, like, you know, 1 in 1,500 versus 1 in 100, or, you know, 2 in 100 that are actually intersex. But to be able to tell at birth is a little bit of a different story. And there are a lot of people out there that didn't have the same good fortune as me in being able to escape something that they didn't want in the first place. And that, I think, with the bills, it's not a bill, but the gubernatorial orders that we're kind of railing against here in Texas right now. And going back to the first question about, you know, what does the LGBTQ community need to know about being intersex? I think there's been some really conflicting information put out there about what actually happens. Like, you know, we've gotten statements from the trans community saying sex assignment surgeries don't happen on children, or reassignment surgeries don't happen on children. They don't happen on trans kids.
That's true.
They happen on intersex kids.
Interesting.
The very same surgeries that they are so pissed about and saying never, never, never. Well, unless.
I've never thought about that wording like that.
Yeah,
I never thought about it until you just said that. And now I'm like.
Because that's one of the biggest things that the trans activists say is that, you know, for trans kids, it's just usually puberty blockers. It's usually a social transition. But that is so true.
Yeah.
Wow.
That there are
surgeries
that happen on kids
without
their consent, and we never ever talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
I have never heard of a trans child having a surgery. Like, I guess it might have happened, but the trans stories I know and the trans people I know, if they choose surgery, it's when they choose as an adult, you know?
Most doctors won't do it on kids.
This paranoia
is not.
It's made up. It's a made up paranoia to scare people, and these things aren't actually happening.
All right, y'all. I am actually going to have to cut this episode short, so please stay tuned to part two of this really amazing conversation that we're having with Lane and Emily. There's a lot here, and I feel like there's a lot of information that needs to be clearly articulated, given that especially recently this is such a hot topic in society, in today's society, especially with all the legislation that's been coming up. So please tune in on part two of our conversation with Lane and Emily. Thanks.
You can find more information about this episode and the show at our website, southernqueries.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching Southern Queries. Queries is with two E's. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Some credits. Production, your hosts, India and Aubrey. Audio mixing by Allison Hawley. Story research, Aubrey Calvin. Editing, India Bastian. This is Southern Queries. Oh.